Jewel. You don't need to know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is the author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play, please.
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Hello, it's time again for the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Today, we have two wonderful pioneers in the world of advertising. The first being Valerie Graves, whom Advertising Age magazine, the Bible of the industry, named one of the 100 best and brightest in the entire industry. In her award-winning career, she was chief creative officer at Uniworld and Vigilante Leo Burnett ad agencies, senior vice president, Motown Records, and a creative consultant for President Bill Clinton. Tony Barreto, a founding member of the National Council of Puerto Rican Women. Tony's early career was spent in radio and television sales with GAF Broadcasting, the National Black Network, the Spanish International Network, and Inner City Broadcasting, and she was director of marketing sales at Chisholm Mingo Group. Moving to the Virgin Islands, she became the press secretary for Governor Alexander Farley. She went on to form an award-winning advertising and marketing agency in the Caribbean, the Tri-Alliance Marketing Group, then back in the United States as VP of Gilbert, Whitney, and John. She managed the Western Union International Global Public Relations effort. Welcome to the broadcast to both of you. It's so wonderful for you all to be here on the broadcast. And the first thing I want to start off with, I don't know which one to start off with, since I usually say the oldest go first, and I don't know whether y'all going to admit to that.
Well, that's the wrong opening for two ladies.
Alphabetically, we'll start with Tony. Oh, tell me about your childhood, where were you born at, and what kind of schooling that you went to? Go ahead.
I was born in New York City. I grew up on Riverside Drive and 158th Street. I'm Puerto Rican. So my parents were born in Puerto Rico, and I was born in New York, and lived in a brownstone with all my relatives living upstairs, my aunts, my cousins, all that kind of stuff. Never knew what lonely was, never knew what hungry was. Went to Catholic school straight through high school. We moved from New York City, we moved to Brooklyn. I went to high school in Brooklyn.
Actually,
what happened is, in those days, the real estate people were cheating people out right and left. My dad bought that brownstone on 158th Street Riverside Drive, and he did not realize at the time that he took his mortgage out, paid his money faithfully. He was a merchant seaman, and made sure that there was plenty of money in the house. We had everything in the world. He signed a 5-year balloon mortgage, and he didn't realize it. He came home one day in a cab from Pier 86, and all of our stuff was on the street.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so one of those situations. So we moved to Brooklyn, stayed with family, eventually got our own place, and then I went to Bishop McDonald High School. I was one of maybe 5 or 6 black girls there. Went through that Catholic school experience, although I do credit the nuns because they taught me how to sit, stand, walk, and talk, and be an independent woman. It wasn't all bad. I went to Medgevis College. I got a CUNY BA. That CUNY BA at that time meant that you could go to any college, take any courses you wanted to in the CUNY system, and put together your own bachelor's degree. So I graduated with a bachelor's degree in psychology. And I didn't go into psychology. I wound up going into advertising.
Yeah.
I went into selling airtime. I was one of the first trainees at Westinghouse Broadcasting in national radio sales. I started the opposite. Most people started a local radio station. I started in national sales and trained there, and then went on to WNCN Radio, classical music station.
I want to talk about that particular piece, but first I want to go and let Valerie talk about her childhood, and I'm going to come back to you. This makes it interesting. Okay, Valerie, where were you born at?
I was born and raised in Pontiac, Michigan, which is about 25 miles north of Detroit. In boom times for auto workers and the industrial middle class. My folks were divorced. I didn't get the full benefit of my dad being an employee of Fisher Body, and he was a union guy who became a union steward and parlayed a little bit of power into a lot of power. You had a job at Fisher Body and you were Black and had to see my father. But we didn't see a whole lot of benefit from that. But like Tony, I don't remember really wanting for things. It was more a little bit of waiting for things. Like maybe you can get that next week or next paycheck, something like that. But my mother was a great manager of money. So we managed to have dancing lessons and music lessons and all of the things that allowed us to express our creativity. I have two brothers, one of whom was raised by my great grandparents and the other one in the house with me. And we were all like the little notoriously smart kids in the neighborhood. And that kind of became my identity, because at that time, if you didn't have powerful professional parents or light skin and long hair, find some other way to distinguish yourself. And I quickly found out that being articulate and this little smart kid was my calling card. And so I was very much known for that. I was like at eight, I was going to Harvard or Radcliffe, wherever you had to go in those days. And then my mother remarried when I was 13 and my brother was 15. And she married literally the guy next door who had two teenagers. And it's just the world blew up. The kids didn't get along. My parents' young marriage was almost immediately fraught with all kinds of problems, mostly connected to us. But during that time, I lost my way and I ended up pregnant at 15, really. And my son was born when I was 16. So all of these plans that I had and the community had and my church family had and everyone for me and these expectations for my future all were just up in the air and what was going to happen to me. I did still manage to graduate from high school a year early. And so I went to college pretty much on schedule after getting a job as a ward clerk in the local hospital, which I kept for a long time, all the time that I was in school. I finally...
What school did you go to?
What college?
Yes.
Wayne State University in Michigan. It's still the number three or four. There's U of M and Michigan State, and then probably Wayne and Oakland University, which is also near. It's a big school. It had 35,000 students when I went there. University of Michigan, where several of my family members went and graduated, the undisputed number one of the big state universities, and then Michigan State, where my husband went to school, is generally considered second. And then there's Wayne. And I have one nephew who is a Wayne graduate. I did not graduate. I was like the little engine that could for a while, you know. Nothing was going to stop me from going to college, certainly. And so I worked. I went to school. I even had a second job. I had a full-time job and I had a part-time job as a tutor at Wayne. And I did that for 2.5 years. And then I just ran out of steam. It's like, I can't do this anymore. I can't be Superwoman anymore. And honestly, I felt that I wasn't particularly learning anything that was going to be helpful to me in making a living and supporting this little boy that I had, that I was just being put through a system. And there was a lot of that kind of thinking those days. They're putting me through a system that is keeping me from advancing. And I just walked out, said I had a degree. Nobody ever doubted me. No one ever questioned me at all about being a college graduate. And I thought, what can I do with the liberal arts studies these chops that I've gotten at Wayne. And in Michigan, where I live, there was publishing, but there also was major league advertising because of the automobile industry. And then fate, luck, whatever, stepped in. And my mother called me up and said, the president of Darcy McManus Majors Advertising gave a speech at the NAACP Freedom Fund dinner. And he said that they are looking for Afro, remember that, Afro-Americans. And didn't you tell me that you sent them a resume? I had naively thinking that's what happened, that you sent them a resume and then they called you.
It doesn't happen like that.
Not at all. But when I called them and said, I understand that Mr. Adams gave the speech and said, blah, 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 blah. I'm Afro-American and no one ever even contacted me to find out if I might be. And living in Pontiac, as opposed to Bloomfield Hills, where the agency was, it was a sign that I might be African-American. So at any rate, they didn't want to be embarrassed. And so they gave me an interview. But by that time, I was already writing a little bit professionally. I had a freelance gig writing the program magazine for a big music theater called Pine Knob, which is like Westbury Music Theater, where all the big national acts came through on that route that led to probably Chicago during the summer. So I was writing about big national rock and other R&B acts like Stevie Wonder, for example, just writing that entire program book. So I did have some writing samples to take in. Mm-hmm. And they said, we see that you can write, but we don't know if you can write advertising. So take these ads home and redo them. Do what you would do. And of course, I was back in a flash. And that's how I got my first job at Darcy, which was a building that I used to pass by all the time. It's on Woodward Avenue, which is your shot going straight to Detroit from Pontiac. And I used to look at this big mid-century modern, beautiful building and think, boy, I don't know what they do in there, but I want to work in a building like that.
Okay, I'm going to get back to that. And I have a story for me in terms of that, but I want to get back to Tony, since you had started in terms of WCN, Tony. And after you talk about that, I wanted to talk about a situation in terms of WCN.
Oh, that was the beginning of those set-asides. It set aside a couple of places for us. That's how I got into the Westinghouse Broadcasting Training Program, and then WNCN hired me. All of these people were trying to keep their FDA, their FCC licenses, so they were hiring at least one for each one. But when I was coming up, the things that really influenced me was I was part of the early Aspida Club organization that realized that Puerto Rican kids were not going to college, and so helped me to even think about myself as college material, because nobody in my house had gone to college. My father was very bright. He was a socialist and an independentista. He believed in the independence for Puerto Rico, and he was going to go to college, but his scholarship was taken away by the Americans because he was training guerrilla fighters on the beaches in Ponce. And they didn't like that. So hit him, and they were killing people in the massacre of Ponce. You know that how you had the situation in California where they shot students who were protesting? Well, literally the same thing happened in Puerto Rico. My dad escaped to the United States and became a merchant seaman. So I grew up not realizing that I could go to college or anything like that, and Aspida helped me to do that. But one of the things that I did have growing up was a tremendous sense of my Africanness. My father was a Marcus Garvey person. He would tell me that sin Africa no hay Hispanidad, which means that with Africa there is no Spanish culture. He would lecture me about 7 centuries of Moorish rule. He said everything that you look at that is from Spain came from us. So I kind of grew up with a serious attitude of superiority rather than inferiority. So when I had these set-asides and these things, I had a foundation to really handle some of the stuff that went on in broadcasting early on. And you can relate to some of this, Valerie. My first sale at WNCN Radio, and the demographic for WNCN Radio was white men, 50 plus, 50,000 plus. That was the demographic that I was selling, because, of course, I was very representative of that. And the first thing was a concert that they were doing that was sponsored by the American Can Company. And I forget the name of the music school that was doing it. And naively, I didn't know where to start selling this thing. And I read that Bill May, the president of American Can Company, was in New York City doing something. And I actually picked up the phone and called the American Can Company and asked for Bill May, like I knew him. And guess who answered the phone? It was like 8 o'clock in the morning. It was Bill May. And I told them the Rochester School of Music was having this concert, blah, 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 blah. Well, it turned out that his daughter was in it. Sponsorship, and it only going to cost you $5.99, and you're going to get 4 spots. He has given him the spiel and everything. He said, "That's very interesting, young lady. I'll have somebody from my staff call you later on." So he hung the phone up, and of course I said, "Well, I'm never going to hear from him." Sure enough, 2 hours later, I got a call, and I sold my first sponsorship at this white station, and they were like, "Where?" To the president of the American Can Company. They thought, "What kind of juju this girl?" I'm just blessed. I was very blessed. And from there, I went to National Black Network and got into black advertising and had ups and downs there. Was sexually harassed by the president of NBN. I can say that because he's passed away. I'm not going to say his name. I was put into the new business development team, which I didn't realize was the exit team, because the guy who he put in charge of it, he wanted to get rid of. So here I am, a young, trying to make an impression in the corporation. You know how that goes, right? On my high heels, my stockings every day. And I didn't realize that this team was not meant to succeed, because in Black Network Radio in those days, it was a new business development union. It would take you 1, 2, sometimes 3 years to get one piece of new business. You had to go to the agencies. You had to tell them, "This is a black person. This is where he lives. This is where he buys. This is the Simmons data, blah, blah, blah." You had to talk to everybody from the janitor on up. And they would say to you, "I don't know if the client," at the agency, "I don't know if the client is going to buy this." So I was trying to sell the client. And I did some incredible things there that I look back on them. I said, I don't even know how I did it. I got Procter & Gamble had just bought Norforms, which was a woman's feminine hygiene product. No feminine hygiene product was anywhere except in magazines. And I was telling them that they could put it on National Black Network, which was an unwired radio network. Wired meant that if you had a commercial, you would literally put your commercials in a donut in the middle of the program and you would mail it to them. You would send it to them, okay? And then they would put their commercials around their programming and other, but your commercials were a donut in the middle of it. So we had an unwired radio network of 100 stations. Some of them were like little wooden shacks with a big antenna on top in the middle of a cornfield someplace. Mm-hmm. And so I told them, yes, you could have Norforms on Black Network Radio. Could you imagine black people selling feminine hygiene products? They didn't really care. Money was money. So I took the commercial and I literally read it to each one of the 100 stations on the phone, faxed them the script, got their okay. They faxed it back to me, and I go to the advertising agency and to the client with a stack full of acceptances from 100 radio stations. So I literally, as the first person in radio, really in media, to get a feminine hygiene product on the air.
I have one interruption here, Tony. When you were at WCN, I remember that you came, and I had an advertising agency myself at that time with Stanley Suntimer, and we had this client. As a matter of fact, I was on my way to California for something, and when Stanley was going to pitch the client, and he told me about it, and I looked at it, and I said, "Stanley."
I was at WNCN radio and this escort service comes in. I forget the name of the
International.
And they wanted, and I had no idea what escort service. I'm a single parent. I am a single mother. My husband had left me and I had these two children and I was trying to make a living. I had a big apartment. He just picked up his stuff and went. I had to figure it out. So I was going to get this account. And she was saying, "Oh, yes, and we escort people from the United Nations and blah, blah." She made it sound really good.
I'm sure it was all true.
But it was true.
But then she did have a little extra service afterwards. I just wanted to make the sale. So I remember going to you, Steve. I can remember. You never told me that you thought it was a hooker service. No, you thought it was a hooker service. I actually got them on the air at WNCN, convinced them, oh, yes, yes. And see, I did not realize it was a hooker service until she had a press conference because she was opening up a brand new office in New York, on Madison Avenue somewhere. And so she was really feeling herself because now she had an escort service and she had a commercial on a prime radio station. There were only two radio classical music stations. The other one, WQXR, was owned by the New York Times. So this was super respectability for her. So she invites us all from the station to go to her press conference. I had only spoken to her on the phone. When I saw this 6 foot Black woman on hooker high heel coming to the press conference, I immediately knew what she was really selling was that escort. Oh my God. Listen, anything for a dollar. I forgot about that story. That was amazing. And the music director at the time said to me, are you sure these are legit? I said, oh yes, this is legit. Fear now, because I don't know nothing. I don't know nothing. Hey, escort, I didn't even know when, escort, so it was supposed to be a euphemism for something else. Oh my God.
We couldn't believe that we got this commercial on. It was like, oh wow.
I did that. I got Domino Sugar on, Sophisticated Look. I did $1.5 million worth of new business in my first year in the new business development unit, okay? And I didn't think it was nothing, but I was running on adrenaline because I had gone through a divorce. I was hurting like crazy. My children were hurting like crazy, and I needed to take care of the bills, and so I was just running in place. And I ran into a situation where the president, who had sexually harassed me and was harassing me, but I didn't know because I had myopia. I was focused on just getting my life together. I didn't even realize he was making passes at me. And he was at the end of this year and this great thing that I had done, he gave me a piece of business. He gave me Camel Soup. I didn't realize at the time that Camel Soup was run by a account supervisor, a white woman, who only wanted sharp looking three-piece suit wearing Black men escorting her, taking her out to the 2-hour lunches, and she wanted to be seen in that kind of crowd. So when he had a Black woman come to call on her, she was like not having it. She had all kinds of complaints about me. So one day he calls me into the office, okay? He had invited me to dinner, lunch, this weekend's go to Antigua with him, go to Jamaica with him. And I was like, I'm sorry, I don't have anyone to take care of my children. I'm like that. He calls me and he fires me because I'm not servicing his Camel Soup client, who was the most important. It was the most important advertiser in Black media at the time. Remember, Steve? Fires me, and I take my little pocketbook and my files, and I go home. And in those days, you left one job, and 2 or 3 weeks later, you could get another job. That's exactly what I did. Years later, I had moved to the Virgin Islands, and I came back to visit some friends on Madison Avenue, and I see my old boss, and he was a huge, he was like 6'7". I see him on Madison Avenue. He says, girl, you're going to live a long time. We were talking about people who had come through National Black Network who could really sell. That what you did, nobody else has ever been able to duplicate in 1 year. I was astonished because I had been fired from the job. Mm-hmm. I had done so good that I got fired. They saw us as a meal ticket, as a green dollar, but they didn't really have a lot of respect for us.
Certainly, advertising doesn't respect any junior copywriter, but you're right. They saw me as a meal ticket, rather, in the sense that the government was leaning on agencies, on businesses a little bit in those days, mm-hmm. to more reflect the communities that they served, and accounts like the Army, which used to be a big account, things like that. You couldn't get them unless you were shown to be making a good faith effort to bring in minorities, et cetera, et cetera. I got the job, but I was filled with remarks like, oh yeah, we get 2 points for you, Black and female. And people had no qualms about saying things like that in those days. I was one of two women. It was funny. My first real creative director, I'd been on the job for 2 weeks, maybe. And I started. They hired me as a junior copywriter. But when I showed up for my first day of work, the guy who had hired me, who was a VP, was taking me around and introduced me to the creative director, Ron. And he said, this is Valerie, and she's the new junior copywriter. Valerie doesn't really have any experience in advertising, so we're going to have her go down to traffic for a couple of weeks and learn how the whole process works. And the guy looked at me, didn't crack a smile, the creative director, and said, you're very lucky. It took me 2 years to get out of traffic. So that was my introduction to the new big boss of my department. So they sent me down to traffic. Well, I had been working in a hospital as a ward clerk for 7 years since I graduated from high school. So the little stuff they're doing in traffic, I could do in my sleep. I was used to a busy hospital environment. So every time I wasn't doing something in traffic, I would run upstairs to the creative floor and say, hey, is there anything I can help out with writing? Blah, 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 blah. So finally, they gave me the opportunity to work on a Dow Chemical ad for industrial glue. And I wrote a headline, stick with the people who know. And they were like, maybe you should come upstairs. So I'm very proud of the fact that I was in traffic for 4 days.
And that's a heck of an accomplishment, because they could have buried you, especially when they saw how talented you were.
And I didn't find, I have to say, I didn't find that they wanted to bury any talent. I didn't. My first creative director, a guy named Hal Bay, who actually went on to be chairman of Darcy and merged it with Benton and Bowles to make DMB&B. Mm-hmm. Hal thought that it would be an interesting experiment to see what it would be like to put some women on a car account. So my partner, who was a Japanese woman named Beverly Okada, and incidentally, we were the only two people from this large group that we went into, whoever went on to New York and had careers. She became a creative director at Saatchi & Saatchi in New York. But anyway, Hal scooped up these two little girls. Our combined salary was probably a rounding error somewhere. He thought, okay, we'll take these two little girls and put them in the Pontiac group. So I'm pretty sure I was the first Black female copywriter on the Pontiac Motor account, which is very befitting coming from Pontiac, Michigan, and having gasoline in my veins. I grew up on cars. But he put us in that group, and the rest is history. But it was Beverly, me, and 22 men. And I can't say that anybody sexually harassed me, but my boss was the kind of person who would call us in and say, listen, girls, Mr. Jones, who was the chairman of Darcy, he likes to like feel the girls and pinch the girls and stuff like that. So yeah, watch yourselves. Gave us the warning before going to the office Christmas party or something to watch out for Mr. Jones, because Mr. Jones liked to do these things. And of course, there were people who were willing to go along with that. None of them Black or Japanese. My boss used to just disappear with his secretary into his office. I wonder
what he was doing.
Like in those days, there was a whole lot of that. There was a lot of partying because the car business was seasonal. They introduced the new Pontiac car line with much fanfare in September, which meant that we worked very hard from, let's say, January through April, and then it started to taper off. Christmas time, of course, was party time, but we just didn't work very hard except when we were creating the advertising for the following season, and we would come to work basically 9 to 5, go home for 2 hours, and come work from 7 until the boss said, let's go home, let's knock off for the night until midnight or 1 o'clock. But the rest of the time, we basically weren't working hard. The two-hour lunches, the whole advertising mythology was pretty standard for the first part of my career. But I also wasn't real serious about work at that time. I had a real love of rock and roll and the whole music scene. Did you say party girl? More of a music mall. I was writer. Please don't call me a groupie, because I wrote about musicians. So I was like that cute girl who wrote for the music magazine and liked to hang out. But I liked hanging out as much as I liked my job. So for my first couple of jobs at Darcy and BBDO, I was recognized as being really pretty talented, but I was also a screw up. I was not serious about the job.
But at the time, we really didn't have any role models. Like, we didn't know where this, we needed a job. We did not know where it could lead to. It wasn't like we could envision ourselves being chairman of the board or being the head of this department or that department, because it just didn't, even, I was at Black Network Radio. I was in Black advertising. I became the director of integrated marketing at the Chisholm Bingo Group. And Sam Chisholm had the vision of integrated marketing. It was just beginning to happen because I had done the sales part. I had the PR background. And so he wanted someone who could look across the line at all of the different departments and come up with a unified strategy. And one of the things that he put me on was, for General Motors, was the Henrietta Marie. Henrietta Marie was a slave ship found off the coast of Florida by Mel Fisher and was traveling around the country. And the interesting thing was they were doing the American Experience with Ken Burns. They just started doing that. And they wanted to show the underpinnings, the backstory of the historical stories. And the backstory for General Motors of slavery, interestingly enough, was slavery as a business, as an economy of the United States. And nobody was talking about it at the time. So we had this replica of a slave, of the inside, the hull of a slave ship. We had visuals of how they slept on the bunks. We had a little boy narrating, talking about how he had gone out into the fields to get water for his mother, and someone trapped him, and he never saw his mother again, that kind of thing. And we're traveling it through the South. And when we're traveling through the South, the people that objected to it the most was Black folks. Why are you bringing that thing up? Why do you want to talk about that? We in civil rights. We far beyond that. Blah, blah, blah. That kind of thing. So there's a lot of crab in the barrels in a Black agency. You remember that, Stephen?
Actually, I remember I started the Black Education Network.
Right.
My first national account came from, ta-da! Tony!
That's right. And it was the most appropriate place for it to be. But I got to talk to creative. I got to influence the buying department. I was able to go across the line. And I really like that, being eclectic like that. See, that's right. That, I remember. Boy, oh boy, are you bringing back some memories, boy.
With the incident that I talked about in terms of WCN, that made me consider you the greatest advertising person ever, from my perspective.
Between that and the Chisholm Bingo Group and General Motors, I was drifting because I really didn't have an intention. After that, I became vice president at Gilbert, Whitney & Johns, working on Western Union. And our job, they had, Gilbert, Whitney & Johns was an advertising agency out of Whippany, New Jersey. And they had Western Union business to business, Quick Collect, okay? But they were doing that side of it. And Western Union was just beginning to recognize the immigrant market and beginning to react to it. They were starting to get Dominicans living in Switzerland sending money back home. So they wanted someone to come in and help them form relationships with these communities and start to get a hold of them for advertising. My job was to put up that relationship together nationally. I did everything from Arab conferences where I couldn't go. I had to have all male event people. I did 150 events nationwide for Western Union and helped them to form a relationship with FIFA, the soccer people, and did all of these things. At some point in time, once the thing got successful, they decided they wanted a white guy to head it and not me. Okay, even though it was business that was dealing with nationalities, of course, the Spanish people, we did advertising. Whatever event we were sponsoring here in the United States, we would advertise back in the country. And our competition at the time was family carriers, people that would put your money in a pouch, get on a plane, and go deliver it to your mother up in the mountain. That was Western Union's competition. That was how early on this was, okay? Once they realized the enormity of the market, I said, oh, no, white Spanish men have to be the ones that are handling this, that kind of thing. But I was the one who started them off.
Valerie, how was your experiences vis-a-vis being a Black woman in a traditionally white business?
I wasn't a threat to them. So my challenge was not to become their mascot. I can remember I had moved from Darcy because of my love of being out with musicians and music involuntarily, lost that job, and then immediately got hired by BBDO in Detroit. And I do remember being at like the big fancy dinner that they had, because they said, we're a pretty small office of BBDO, but we don't even all know each other. So we need to go out and get together and have some drinks and introduce ourselves. So they had this dinner at the Bloomfield Open Hunt Club, which is one of those bastions of whiteness. Bloomfield Hills is a very affluent suburb where General Motors executives and owners of companies that supplied them tended to own big houses. And I've been driving past it my whole life, coming from our little section of Pontiac, Michigan. But anyway, so they had this big dinner. Everyone serving us was Black. I was the only Black attendee. These little women and these guys, you know, who still had the dues laid back and all that, the epitome of brown service, were serving us. And so on that, I would like try to catch their eye. They wouldn't even look at me, I think, because they didn't know what I was really going to be like. But at any rate, there came this portion of the dinner where you were supposed to stand up, say your name, talk about what you did for the agency. Of course, the creatives in particular, everybody had to be really funny about what it was they did for the company. So when they got to me, I thought, well, how am I gonna hang in here with these guys? And I said, Valerie Graves, copywriter, and token. And the Black people who were working there were looking at me like, girl, I hope what you're doing. They really were, because they were all standing around the edges of the room in case anybody wanted anything. And then all of the BBDO people just cracked up laughing, and they've been drinking anyway, of course, because I knew better than to get drunk with these people. So at any rate, the next day, the CEO of our office passed by my doorway and went, copywriter, token, blah, blah, blah. 2 weeks later, I got laid off. A guy who was working there, he was new. He was coming in when I was leaving as one of the creative directors, told me, he kind of liked me, I think, but he told me, it was like, oh, that did it for you. And I was like, I don't care. I wrote about it in my book. And what I said was, F them if they couldn't take a joke. I've been saying what they wanted to hear my whole life.
Proud of you.
Moved to another town. And that was good for me, because that was when I finally made the break from music and said, okay, I'm going to be in advertising. And I moved to Boston and started working at K&E. And then I went from being the only Black person in the BBDO office in Detroit to being the only Black creative professional in the city of Boston.
Wow. You were promoted, huh?
Yeah, from only to only at a higher level, I guess.
Only the lonely.
He took me out for a drink at the end of my first week in Boston. He said, I just want to know, why the hell did you come to Boston? This has got to be the hardest place in the world for you to find a job. And I said, yeah, it's not easy for a Black person to find a job in any city. Mm-hmm. So I came to Boston because I had one friend here who invited me to come here and live with them until I got settled, got a job, got my own apartment, which happened in pretty short order. And when I left Boston, I came back to the Detroit area because I reconnected with the man who would become my husband, whom I met when I was 11 years old. And we were classmates in the smart track in junior high school. I should write a whole book about that, Homeroom 202, because it was all like the smart kids feeding in from several elementary schools into our junior high school. And we all went every class together. When in the eighth grade, we had dancing. My husband, now 40 years, was my dance partner then too. But essentially, we were just classmates, and we went.
You thought you were just classmates. He had a master plan.
He didn't know there was a master plan, but he has told me he had a daydream when he was 13 and he couldn't figure out where it came from, that I was his wife, just out of nowhere. But we were just classmates. And then we met again when we were in our 20s working on a political campaign, and went out a little bit and loved each other, but we were both like in different places then. And I moved to Boston and he moved to Washington to go to school some more. My husband is a person who's been to school a lot. I made up for not graduating. I'm married in education now. I've been to Columbia and Stanford and everywhere else with my husband. So where did I leave off? Boston. Eventually, I made my way to New York for the first time. My husband.
What made you decide to come to New York?
My husband was getting a master's degree in journalism at Columbia. And by the way, Tony, our friend Michael Cotman wrote the book about the Henrietta Marie.
Oh, that's
interesting. I remember like we were all pretty close during that time when he was writing that book. And Marie Brown, who was my agent, thank God for my book, was Michael's agent for the Henrietta Marie
Prize. Interesting. I'm surprised that our paths did not cross. Wow. They have crossed right now. That's right. You've got to give us we've got to exchange numbers, Valerie. Absolutely.
Absolutely. We must stay in touch. But I was only in New York for that year that he was getting a master's right then. And we went back to Detroit because my son was in high school and we wanted to get him launched. But after 3 years in Detroit, during which I became a vice president at a big regional white Michigan agency called Ross Roy, I had done some freelancing for Uniworld Group. They had been supposed to hire me right after I married my husband when he was going to Columbia. And then they reneged. They sent me like a little bit of money, but said, well, we were talking to you because we thought we were getting this one account and we didn't get it. And my husband and I came to New York just broke. We had just a few bucks that I got for a freelance assignment. We knew that he was going to have some student financial aid coming, but we didn't know when. We got down to our last $60. And I remember like getting on my knees and just saying a prayer to God, help us. We had student housing at Columbia and the rent was paid, but otherwise we didn't know where anything was coming from. And I woke up in the morning, I had a telegram because we didn't even have a phone yet, from J. Walter Thompson offering me a job.
Wow.
So that's how I ended up working in New York for the first time.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
We need to have a show just on the world of Black advertising.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was the plantation, Black advertising plantation was just a whole other world. Oh, my gosh.
It was heaven also.
It was exciting. Byron
recruited me after he had left me stranded, right after we spent all our money on our wedding, just knowing that I had this job in New York. And so we ended up with nothing until I got that job at Thompson. So we were out there for about a month wondering what was going to happen to us. But Byron never lost touch with me. And he offered me some very lucrative freelance work while I was working at Thompson. So that kind of made up for what they had done to me before. And I was still open to the idea of doing African-American advertising, but I'm sure, Tony, you didn't like just lightly give up a general market job.
No, you didn't give up a job for a Black
movie. It'd be hard to come back.
Pam Chisholm?
Oh, yeah. Very. Yeah, all those guys. Carolyn, who came out of
Carolyn Jones. I had a freelance job with Carolyn Jones for a while too.
Yeah, that's another whole story too. Because I had some interviews lined up. I had Uniworld first, and then Carolyn Jones. And Uniworld interview was going so well. They keep bringing the next person to meet you, and the next that I had to call and cancel Carolyn. I don't think she ever really forgave me for that, even though I tried to apologize. I sent her some flowers, that kind of thing. It was just like, now you're
all. They were really walking a real tightrope at that time. They were all token Blacks, but they couldn't be too Black.
Yeah.
And they couldn't be too white because they had to be able to interpret the community to white people. So they would say they were really sitting in the middle time.
We all had that experience, like you described it. When you first start trying to talk to Black people and you're just being real and telling everything and putting it out there, you have to learn that there are things that we don't really want to see in advertising, that we feel the role of advertising is to be aspirational. And you can be authentic, but being able to be authentic requires expertise. That's the reason you keep seeing all these big screw-ups from general market agencies and big brands like Pepsi and all of that we all just look and go, oh, I could have told you. But the reason we could have told them is because we did some of it ourselves. I did a big campaign for Coors Beer, like at the beginning of hip hop, and we called it Turn It Up. And we had all guys in hip hop gear and all that. Now, in casting it, we really made sure that everyone was not only 21, we didn't cast anyone who was less than 25 years old because we were concerned. It didn't matter. They looked young and hip, and we got blasted by the Black community for promoting alcohol and drinking to like young kids. And it was like, none of these people were anything approaching being, but you have to know what you're doing to do that kind of advertising. But boy, from the moment that Byron Lewis finally recruited me away from Ross Roy, where I had become a vice president just a few months before, but I also knew that was it for me. That's like the real glass ceiling when they let you have a little piece of the pie. It's like, and they weren't saying that to me, but I just knew it. And also I had a mentor there who was a Black vice president, a senior vice president, who had parlayed his influence in the Black community of Detroit into that position at Ross Roy. But he also gave me a heads up, you got nothing more coming from them. You do know that, don't you? And Byron had designated a person to call me once a month and offer me this job. And he finally called me just at the time that my husband was ready to make a move to a bigger market, to a bigger newspaper. And so the planets just aligned, and that's how I came to Uniworld. But the instant that I got there, it was like, oh, this is me, you know, this is me. I didn't get recruited back into white advertising, not ever. Right after I joined Uniworld, I was named one of the 100 best and brightest in the industry of advertising, but I was never recruited again by a white agency. I was recruited by Bill Clinton to work on a presidential campaign. I was recruited by Andre Harrell to become senior vice president of Motown Records, but never again did a white agency offer me a job as a creative director.
Tony, I'll switch back to you, and then I'm going to go back to the Motown era of Valerie. You left the United States and you went to Virgin Islands. What made you decide to go to the Virgin Islands?
It's an emotional decision, actually. My son, my youngest son, has ADHD and was not really doing well in school. My mom had passed away, so my support system for me and my children was gone. My mom had passed away. My father had given me these two buildings in Brooklyn that he was going to sell to a plumber for $12,000. And I said, Dad, give them to me. Let me renovate them and sell them for you, and we'll split the money. So after I did, that was an adventure and a half, evicting people. I had a man die in one of the buildings. One of the tenants tried to kick my ass because I was trying to, because she wasn't paying any rent. She was running every racket known to man out of her apartment. It was a two-year adventure, and I was exhausted between working a full-time job, trying to do these two buildings for my dad. That meant every evening and weekends I was always out there, and raising my children by myself without my mother around, who was like, she was like, here, go to mommy's house. And then my son had gotten in trouble in school and was asked to leave. So I didn't know what I was going to do next for him. I had him at this private school. I was paying at that time $1,000 a month. I had an extra job, a freelance job, just to pay for that. So I just decided I'm taking 3 weeks off. I had to find him another school anyway. And I went back to the Virgin Islands. I had used to spend every summer either in Puerto Rico or my people are from Vieques and Culebra, either there or in St. Thomas or St. Croix with my aunts. So I went back to St. Croix just for vacation, and I just connected with all my cousins and saw how easy life was and how easy it was to access everybody. And I had some money. We sold the buildings. So I just went for 3 weeks and came back home and packed everything up and left. And it turned out to be one of those things where when you think of like someone swinging in midair where they catch the next ring, it happened to be the next ring for me. I was there. I was living with my cousin. I was there about a month. I placed my son in school, and I was thinking about maybe starting a business. I had some cash, but I wanted to see what the island would need. And it turned out that my cousin's husband had been the new governor's campaign manager, Spanish for the Spanish market. So I go to lunch one day. I printed up a bunch of resumes, and I'm having lunch in Frederickstead on the beach, and I meet this lady who said, oh, I've worked on the governor's campaign. I said, well, I'm going to have my resume. And I gave her a copy of it. It was Claire Roker. And she turned out to be one of his main people. And 2 days later, I get a call from Governor Farrelly. And he says, hi, this is Governor Farrelly. And smart asked me, I say, uh-huh, and I'm Minnie Mouse. You're not Minnie Mouse, but I am really Governor Farrelly. So he offered me the position of press secretary for the Virgin Islands. And I went on a four-year journey. First of all, I was met with Hurricane Hugo right after that. So Hurricane Hugo, I was part of the emergency response team, working with FEMA, working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, running around the islands, trying to tell people where the water buffaloes are, and where they can get this and where they can get that. So that was a year. And then after that, working with the Department of Education, working with the Department of Economic Development, getting businesses down to the Virgin Islands to sell them what we had. And for them to put businesses there. I helped to detail the visit of the Queen and King of Denmark to the Virgin Islands. Virgin Islands were the property of Denmark, and then they sold it to the United States. I did a referendum campaign called Choose or Lose, because the Virgin Islands is literally the property of the United States. It has no status before the United States. It doesn't even have the status of Guam, okay? It has no status. So I did a lot of exciting things. The governor was an interesting person. He was a widower and a bon vivant. He had been Leon Hess's lawyer with Hess Oil, a big oil refiner on the island. Huh?
Used to own the Jets.
That's right. Okay, that's correct. And so that's a world that Alexander Farrelly traveled in, and he had a memory that he remembered what diaper he wore when he was, and he had ladies galore. So part of my unofficial job was to keep all of these ladies, and they were his lawyers and Indian chiefs. We're not talking about Mary from around the way here. These classy, educated women who went crazy for this man. He wasn't especially good looking, but he always had this incredible manner about him. He could remember if you had a martini dry, four olives, he would remember that's what you drank. And if he saw you 10 years later, he would say, I know exactly what you drink. And we would be like, oh, I really made an impression on him. So sometimes my job was running around at 2-3 o'clock in the morning trying to get some professional lady out the bush where outside of the governor's hotel room where she was talking him, and I'm talking her down, and he's in the room with somebody else. So I'm trying to keep him separate. So it was a very interesting journey, and I wound up moving on and had my own advertising agency, Tri-Alliance Marketing Group. And I won Addy Awards for my work. I had Barclays Bank, which really doesn't advertise, but they started to advertise with me in the Virgin Islands. I had Jamaica. I had the American Paradise Triathlon, which was televised on ESPN. Actually, it was televised initially on the Madison Square Garden network. And all these networks then got together and became ESPN. I did some incredible things. I consider it to be one of the happiest times of my life. And the only reason I left was the Hurricane Andrew came along and kicked our butts again. The local high school was closed, and my son was supposed to graduate that year. And he was very happy because he could be home and look at TV. And so I got scared that he wasn't going to graduate, send him to my cousin in Texas, and decided to try and come and get some business from New York, because I had business, but the government wasn't paying me any money, and everything was down. So I started looking at some people that I had worked with in New York, an agency that I worked with, and trying to bring in some freelance business. And then I said, I can't work for New York and live here. So I moved back home. There was really nothing for me at that point because the island was recovering and it was going to be years. As a matter of fact, the St. Croix is still recovering. It's still recovering from Andrew.
Valerie, you moved on to Motown. How was it working with Andre Harrell at that time, right?
Yeah. Can I just go back for a second, though?
Sure.
and talk about some of the stuff that Tony was talking about, because we really were involved with Black advertising in its heyday. And I don't know that we kind of said as much as there is to be said about that. When I left Ross Roy to go to Uniworld, they had no idea what Uniworld was, but they were, so what are you going to be doing there? And who are the clients? And I said, I'm going to be an associate creative director, vice president, the same as here. But their client list, Uniworld had the most incredible client list because we were just the African American portion of the account, but they had Burger King, which is the real reason that I went there, because they were doing TV advertising for Burger King, 7-Up. We got Kodak shortly after I arrived. AT&T was one of our flagship clients, Avon, Smirnoff, on and on. My agency in Detroit was like, oh yeah, I guess I would leave and go there too. And we just had a fabulous time doing advertising. We really, during that era, Uniworld was probably 60 million when I joined it and about 300 million when I left to go to Motown, because we just put them on the map. At that time, if you were doing what I did and what Tony did, and really what Byron and Sam did, I always say that Byron Lewis invented integrated marketing.
And yes, he did. And that Sam followed his lead. Absolutely.
He created a soap opera called Sounds of the City.
Yes.
For General Foods college fairs that went to all of the major urban centers up north, bringing historically Black colleges and universities to the city, because those schools were in the South. A lot of kids had never heard of them. And as a matter of fact, the first campaign that I did when I came to Uniworld was a series of big splashy print spreads in Essence and Ebony for leaders of Black college who had come out of Black colleges, who at that time, I was just astonished that almost anyone who was accomplishing anything in Black America in the 80s had in fact come out of a historically Black college.
It hasn't changed that much, actually. We have a lot of leaders coming out of the Ivy Leagues, but the core, the PhDs, the core, because something about the Black experience gives you your guts, makes you stand, okay? You have something to stand on. I would have cut my right arm off to go work with Byron, okay? I was with Sam Chisholm, and God bless him. He was a genius in some things, but he was not nice to his people, okay? He could put you down with a phrase like, in a moment's notice. He never said thank you for the work that you did. He wasn't grateful for what you did. Everyone else would praise you. Your clients would praise you. You'd go into the client and be a hero and come back to the agency, and Sam would have something to say to knock you down a couple of pegs. So I would have loved to work with Byron, because I always saw him as such a gentleman and such a positive person.
Those things are all true. And that's really how he recruited me to Uniworld in the end. It was just promises made and promises kept, where he was like, work for me. Your intelligence and your talent will be taken for granted. You'll work with everyone who is anyone in Black America. You'll travel and you will be rewarded and promoted. And every one of those things came true for me. My very first day on the job, Arthur Ashe came into the office. He wanted to talk to us about getting support for a program that he had to bring tennis to inner city kids. But it was like that campaign that we did for historically Black colleges. We included Jesse Jackson, Earl, the Pearl, Monroe. I got to New York in 1985. I did have a chance to know all kinds of national leaders because of Byron and the promises that he made to me about what the Uniworld experience was going to be like.
It was a magic time. That time, that period of time in our lives was just magic, because we were just really beginning to feel our oats and understand that what we did could touch the whole world, could touch the whole United States. We were just a fabulous time.
At the Advertising Club of New York, maybe 2 years ago, for Black History Month, the theme was the Golden Age of Black Advertising. Yeah. And it celebrated a lot of the work that we did in the era. They brought in Byron, Byron is a real raconteur anyway. Oh, yes. And he just regained this gathering of people with what it was like to be one of the pioneers in Black advertising. We were just able to bring out a lot of the success of that time, but it was glorious.
Interestingly enough, I just realized that when I moved to the Virgin Islands and started working for Governor Alexander Farrelly, he and Byron Lewis could have been brothers. They were the same coloring, the same height, the same kind of manly gentleness, but there was no this metrosexual thing going on with them. They were in their, and especially say enne cabales, in their, on their feet. Mm-hmm. And I just realized that they were very much very similar. So that's, I think, one of the reasons I was so comfortable with Alexander Farrelly, because I just fell right into place.
And David Dinkins would have been their triplet.
Oh, yeah. Those three people would have been triplets. Yes. They would have been triplets. And it was a particular kind of man, a man of their age, because they didn't come by what they had and who they were easily at all. You know?
Valerie, what was one of your most memorable commercials with Uniworld? I know there were many.
I was there for 14 years. One of my favorite Uniworld commercials is one of my first Burger King productions. And it was a commercial that I felt really captured the essence of Burger King, which is have it your way. In that era, it was called Fashion Statement, and it was a parade of Black people in really statement-making garb. We're the first commercial to show brothers with dreadlocks and things like that. Herbie Hancock did the music score for it. Oscar Brown Jr. was our voiceover. And it really just took over the airwaves. Back then, just go back to Cuba Gooding Jr., Burger King commercial. I think that may have been the first thing he ever did. And he got it through a bit of serendipity, because the first shot of the commercial is him sitting on a bridge in a park in Los Angeles. It's a very famous park, just the name is escaping me right now.
MacArthur
Park. And the actor who was supposed to do the role with this big parrot on his shoulder was afraid of the bird, which I didn't blame him. It was a great big parrot, and Cuba was like, "Who? Give it to me, I'll do it." And he opens the spot with this bird on his shoulder and these shades on, and it just takes off from there. So that was probably my really just favorite piece of work that holds up. If you did it now, we had the little boy with the gold chain necklace on, a little kid who was about 5 or 6 years old who was really into it. So we had hip hop culture. We had Afrocentric garb. It was just the blackest thing out there. And it was on the air all the time. Back then, we used to get just a portion of the general market rotation. And then there was also airtime that was local, that was bought by regional franchisees, that kind of thing. And instead of running the general market ad, everyone was running our ad. We took over the entire rotation, especially because of Herbie's soundtrack, which was based on Rocket. We did our demo when we sold in the concept. We used Herbie Hancock's Rocket. And when we went to our producer, Bernie Drayton, and said, "We need something that is like this." And he said, "You don't want to get caught trying to rip off Herbie Hancock's sound. Why don't we just get Herbie?" So we ended up getting Herbie Hancock, got to go out and collaborate with Herbie, working with him in his studio out behind his house in the garage. So the production experience was great. We gave Cuba Gooding his first opportunity. And I saw him again, like years and years later. And I said, "See, you probably don't remember, but a long time ago, I put a big parrot on your shoulder." And he said, "Burger King, how you doing, baby?" So it was just a great experience. So I like that. But my favorite overall experience also involved Burger King, where I don't know if you remember, but Burger King used to change agencies pretty often.
Yes.
And everybody but us. The world was always the constant while they looked for a general market agency. And the last time that they did it, they said, "Okay, we're going to allow you to compete for the interim assignment for about 6 months to do this while we do our agency search." So we competed against Saatchi & Saatchi.
Wow.
We won. We were not allowed to talk about that. that was a condition of our getting this $100 million media assignment. You can't tell anybody that you beat Saatchi to get it. And my husband, who's a journalist, I had a connection to a reporter, the business reporter at Newsday where my husband worked. So I gave him the scoop and he said, he called me back and he said, you know what? I'm gonna write the story, but you should know they don't really want people to know that you got it. Adweek greeted our victory by writing a story that began as a sign that things have truly become chaotic at Burger King, the general market investment. Yeah.
We've always worked around and known that it was there, this white resentment of us and our, as we were climbing the ladder and succeeding, because we were seen as arrogant in those days, and we were arrogant. Everything was going our way. Martin Luther King, civil rights, we're winning. We got ads on TV. We got this going. We got that going. We were the first generation to have it like that. Yeah. Okay? We were the first ones to have it like that. Fast forward to the amount of resentment that there is today, to the point that these folks out here, Republicans out here, are willing to take over the United States in an insurrection, to lie, to take over from us so that we don't win anymore. They can't stand it anymore. They can't stand seeing us successful everywhere you look. And everything is changing so fast for them. We were the era that started this thing of success. And when you're young and successful, there's an arrogance about you. There's an air about you. Nothing that you do can go wrong.
I have never known my place. I was like, at first, just too young and stupid to realize that I couldn't get a job in advertising. So I went to a job in advertising. When we had these big accounts at Uniworld, it was like, we're just going to do the best advertising that we can do. And we did things like steal the rotation with that Herbie Hancock commercial. Yeah. That was not taken lightly, general market agencies. And from that point on, they were always trying to kill us. And I think it's the same thing that's underlying what's going on now, which is that there is this perception that whatever we get comes at their expense. They didn't care too much before the whole country started to change color, and that's happening now writ large. They didn't care about the little business that Uniworld had. It was a small percentage of the account. But then those consumers that we served, that we had a relationship with, began to control the culture. And, you know, what Byron said when he spoke to that group during Black History Month was, you know, what advice would you have for people starting out today? He said, what I would do is tell them to act like who you are. You control world popular culture. You control sports. Yes. You control entertainment. You control all of these things. Politics. You control all of these things. You need to act like it and wield power accordingly. That's the truth. You might get shot at figuratively, not literally, but there's always somebody who's going to shoot you down. Our successes at Uniworld were always the key to our getting fired. That happened ultimately on AT&T, certainly on Pepsi.
They'd bring it in-house. They'd find themselves a Black person and bring it in-house.
Yeah, okay. Whatever they need to do in order to do it. I don't know if you remember this is terrible. Why am I drawing blanks on people? I'm getting old. The conservative commentator who got rid of Ludacris, who messed up Ludacris's Pepsi contract, that was my commercials that they got him for. So they ran us off the air. Our successes always led to somebody getting rid of us on that business. The hardest fought was Burger King, but eventually they got that away from Uniworld sometime after I had left.
There's a serious cultural clash going on right now that has been pushed by advertising. I was sitting in my house one night and watching and looking at all of these interracial couples on all of these different commercials. Every commercial had an interracial, either the man was white and the woman was Black, or vice versa, and the little mulatto child. And I picked up the phone to a friend of mine, Vaughn Alexander, who lives in Alabama now. And I said, Vaughn, are you seeing these commercials in Alabama? She says, girl, they're running them down here. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really knew that there was a force in advertising the youth, the multiculturalism, the fact that we weren't homophobic, the creativity that was coming out of advertising was pushing America to a reality that they hadn't quite accepted yet. We were always ahead of the United States in debt. We provided them with the vision.
See, that to me was an economic decision. All of that interracial casting, the whole hoax of total market advertising that was really perpetrated by general market agencies who wanted the total budget. And that's what I call it too, total budget. I think that it's a bit on the way out now because what it lacks is insight. So it's like, you can show as many interracial couples as you want to. What does that have to do with my experience of life, of being a Black American, of the things that we used to drill into very successfully in order to have the successes that we had on the brands that we work for at Uniworld? Just because you cast interracial people, you could be missing everyone. You're missing the white person who doesn't have that as part of their experience, because after all, somewhere between 10 and 12% of marriages in the United States are interracial. It's not justified by reality. It's only justified by, we want this total budget, and they have a client who's willing to do it because, oh, I only have to have one advertising agency and only pay one. Right. And then they make like big stupid mistakes, like with the Pepsi Martin Luther King March advertising and other mistakes that have been made. So the tide, I really think, is going to turn back a bit toward doing commercials targeted to different groups that have authentic insights that come from them. You see that with the formation of advertising agencies like Cartwright with Keith Cart. And then I just read yesterday that there are some big money investors in another Black agency that's just being formed. So I think that the reason I'm not at Uniworld, the reason that I had my contract, like I had a contract that at the end of it was not renewed, let's put it that way. I was not fired from Uniworld, but that's what happened. They didn't offer me a new contract, is because I would not shut up about the fact that we were the ideal general market agency for the time. Mm-hmm. And Byron, at the age he was at that time, was not willing to start something new, to pioneer something new.
It was growing organically from the fact that Black advertising, or urban advertising, as they were calling it, was insightful. It was actually looking at real everyday experiences, not making them up, not fantasies, not this outer space kind of thing that some of the general market agencies were bringing a look and feel that didn't have anything to do with people. And because we had been observers all of our lives in America, we have been ones holding the platter. Someone was telling me that when you went to a middle class Black person's home, they had silverware, they had the china cloths, and they have all of these things because we were in the waiting class. We were in the working class. So we had a front row seat to how people live good, which, well, a lot of white Americans didn't. They were poor. Yeah, they didn't know what, you know, the damask was and linen and all of the things that we do. And we just did it naturally, organically, because that's what we had been exposed to. So our experience of observing us and observing them, white people didn't have that.
That was exactly my point, was they don't know much at all about us. And we know a lot about them because our survival has depended upon it. We are the general market agency of the future. They don't know any better than to do what they have done, which is to get advertising that really doesn't speak to what's important to us. It presents a certain picture, and it's like, not a bad picture. You could have all the total market advertising you want with interracial couples and all that. You would still need advertising that speaks to real Black people.
And pick up all of these people, all the MAGA people along the way. Yeah. I was looking at a DW documentary about the white culture in Appalachia, and a man who was on a food line with his family was saying how he was pro-Trump. Because everywhere you saw Trump, he was a family man. He was seen with his family. You could call that a family. Okay. And I was saying to myself, but now he cut the taxes for the 1%. You're not getting any benefit from any of that. None of that corporate money, those trillions of dollars in corporate money that they're saving or they're making from these tax cuts is going into saving any part of your life. It's not going into infrastructure, education, service, creating new jobs, or any of that. So there's so many layers to America right now. And what they're seeing is just on television is just black success. The Housewives of Atlanta, everything that they're seeing, they're saying, well, they're making it. We're not. We're still sitting up here in Appalachia.
Valerie, how was the transition from being in an ad agency to being in a corporation like Motown?
It was absolutely surreal. I had no idea what the music business was about. Andre Harrell hired me. Honestly, I think he hired me because I had met him before. I met him at the Pink Teacup. He was sitting there.
The Pink Teacup.
Block away from the Pink Teacup. And so we went there all the time. And I ran into Andre and Russell Simmons, and I invited them to come to the Coors Light Show, which was a big promotional program that World had come up with. Speaking of integrated marketing, it had all kinds of components that I won't bore you with, but one of them was a big invitation only party, because that was part of hip hop at that time. It had to be very exclusive. So I had met Andre just in that moment. I was there with my husband, and he came into the agency, as it turned out, to talk to Byron about our doing the advertising promotion for an event at Madison Square Garden that was hip hop response to AIDS. It was called Urban Aid and featured all the big hip hop groups of the day. And we did eventually do that. But when he was in the agency, I waited outside the conference room where he was for a break in the conversation and went in and said, hey, hi, Mr. Lewis, I'm busting into your meeting. And he said, yes, you are. And I said, but I just wanted to make sure that Andre remembers me the next time he sees me, because we met before. He said, I remember you, you and your husband, I met you at the Pink Teacup. And I said, yeah. But even though we did do that project, and I think Andre gained some confidence in me from seeing me head up that team, I think the real reason he hired me was because I was this woman who had the guts to like just bust into Byron Lewis's meeting and say, I know I'm busting into your meeting. And yet, yes, you are. I didn't back down, because that's how Andre was. That's the kind of trait that he admired. But going into Motown, I have to say, it was just a mess right from the beginning. Andre had overhired. He hired everyone he ever thought could do anything. And it was very disorganized to begin with. And he had promised a whole lot to the parent company, PolyGram. So we were doing things that I didn't know the music business then, but I came to know that it was like, it's crazy to try to introduce four or five groups at one time. And that's what we were doing. And of course, we had very limited success in doing that. And there were all kinds of people, you know, who just talked loud and fast and told Andre whatever he wanted to hear. And Andre had a great desire never to lose touch with the streets and to kind of keep real. If anybody ever suggested that anything he was doing was whack, we weren't going to do that. So it was a very disorganized and disorienting experience for me. And I finally found my niche within it by bringing him marketing ideas, which really he brought me in for. But the moment I got there, it was like, yeah, but we got to get these groups going first. And that was the part of the business about which I knew least. And by the time I really learned the business, I knew that I was not a good fit for the business in general, because I'm a straight arrow corporate type person, and it's not really that type of business. Also, I didn't love it because I was not considered a creative in the record business. The creatives are the people who make the record. So I didn't really love that. But it was a fabulous credential to have. A lot of the things that I had talked about and a few of the things that I was able to implement there are now just standard in business. We had a group called Shades who came out right about the same time as Destiny's Child. And so unfortunately, they got blown away by Beyonce, but I got them a contract with Clairol. our jazz label, Mojazz. I got a deal for them with Coors to promote our music. The kinds of alliances that are taken for granted now, that was all very new. And I was able to do a lot of that stuff. I even got Boys to Men involved with the federal government in a campaign against teenage cigarette smoking. So I'm proud of the work that I was able to do in 2 years at Motown, but I have to say it was a crazy and wild experience. I love the friends that I did make there, and I would call them the people who were the grown-ups and not like the craziness of the music business. But yeah, I did use, and they considered it a success in the way that I left there. So it wasn't all bad. It's a wonderful credential to take forward. I now know how the music business operates, and or how it operated then, because it's a whole different business now. But it was an adventure to go and try to do something totally different when you've achieved some degree of success in one industry.
Okay. Tony, what are some of the things that you have that you're doing now and in some of your future projects that you hope to do or will do?
Well, I'm in a totally different world right now. I was teaching for a small while there out of necessity. I got married and my husband at the time developed cancer. And so I could no longer really be a hotshot on high heels running around all over the place because I had to keep an eye on him. So I left the world, I think, and went to teach high school Spanish so that I could be home at 3 o'clock.
Are you good at Spanish?
Of course I am. I was not a good Spanish teacher. I was very strict. I wasn't having no nonsense. I call your mama in a minute. No, I don't hold you up in a minute. That kind of thing. But it was necessity. He passed away in 2004. And then I've been doing real estate since that time. So what I'm doing right now is I am a commercial loan broker. I have a company called Investors Link. I do what they call hard money loans, but I also do commercial business loans, everything from credit card advancing to equipment leasing, really commercial. I don't have a staff or a big office. It's not necessary. I have other brokers working for me. And I remarried 5 years ago, and my husband's a general contractor. I find them and he fixes them, we sell them. And that's what we've been doing. And I'm living in Brick, New Jersey. I've been in New Jersey since I came back from the Virgin Islands. I love living in New Jersey. I love the lifestyle. And I'm here. I'm 2 miles from the beach. So that's where I am right now. My life is completely different. I'm not in the corporate world. I deal with corporations, but as an outsider looking in, I do some big corporate loans, lines of credit and that kind of thing for businesses. I have small businesses and very large businesses, truckings and that kind of thing. It's a different world. It's a completely different world.
Valerie, what are you doing now? And what are your plans?
Some things still come my way as a result of the book that I wrote, Pressure Makes Diamonds. I still do some things that are related to the book. I still get asked to do speaking engagements here and there because of the book. I still do some creative consulting. I think I sent you a link to a spot that I most recently did for the WNBA, urging people to get informed in hopes that they'll get vaccinated because of the toll that COVID-19 takes on Black women and our health. But I've also done some Black History Month work for the NBA and just things that have to do with some of their community relations platforms. So I'm very happy about that. I love it at this stage of my life that I'm still involved with something as hip as the NBA because we are an NBA household. My husband is a huge long-term fan and my son has worked for several NBA teams as a sales executive. I love basketball and I'm a Knicks fan and I can say that proudly again right now after the way they ended the regular season. I'm doing that. I'm still on the board of New Federal Theater.
That's what I was going to ask you about. But you,
yeah, I am. And I created for last fall a streaming music event with Felix Hernandez from Ray's special music mix that was a salute to the era in which New Federal Theater was founded, now 51 years ago, but it was a 50th anniversary salute. It was called 50 Years in the Groove, and it was great. It was music, it was lots of visual imagery, lots of shout outs from people from that era, who included people like Danny Glover, just on and on. And that was one of my favorite things that I've done recently. But my work for New Federal has been very much involved with audience development and bringing New Federal Theater to the attention of another generation of potential theater goers. My mother is now 91 and not in good health. I'm blessed to have the freedom to be able to go to Michigan and be a part-time caregiver to her. So I feel very blessed to be able to do that. And I'm very happy that my book is still out there. And one little anecdote, a couple of weeks ago, I was paying a bill by phone and the customer service representative said, "I don't know if you remember, but I talked to you a few months ago and you shared with me that you were retired from full-time work, but that you had written a book." She said, "I went to the library," which turned out to be in Delaware, "I got your book, and I just wanted you to know how much I enjoyed it and to congratulate you on your career." So that was like insane to me.
So thank you all so much for being part of the show. And that's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Looking forward to seeing you next week. Have a good week.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.